Let's start the session with a meditation, and this time we'll do just one session, 24 minutes long. And the first half we'll do shamatha practice, resting in awareness, and the second half we'll move more into vipassana practice. So we're going to then do some questioning, looking at this awareness in the second half. Okay, so let's do the practice. As always, beginning by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. allowing the eyes to be at least partially open. And simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest, resting in the experience of awareness itself. Not doing anything at all. Just be. Resting in luminously clear awareness. Completely relaxed and alert. Does this awareness have a location? Is it located somewhere? Is it located inside the body somewhere? Is it located inside the head somewhere? Is it located outside the body somewhere? Is there anywhere where it isn't located? Is awareness coming from somewhere? Is it going somewhere? Does awareness have a particular size? Is it small? Is it big? Is there any physical limit or boundary to awareness? So let's go back into the text. So remember this text, the Geluk tradition of Mahamudra from Panchen Losan Chögyi Gyaltsen from 16th, 17th century. He's writing down the instructions coming through the lineage from Lama Tsongkhapa, who received oral instructions from Kagyu masters in the Mahamudra tradition and synthesized that together with his own profound, clear way of presenting emptiness. And so we see that in the Mahamudra tradition here, we can operate at two levels, sutra and tantra. Tantra level, we're trying to gain access to that very subtle mind that we have. To have a basis for that, we can operate first at the sutra level of Mahamudra. And at the sutra level of Mahamudra, the two core practices are shamatha vipassana, of course. Shamatha, to cultivate a stable, clear mind. And on the basis of that, we can engage in the vipassana practice to come to realize the ultimate nature of the mind, to realize that the mind is empty of independent, inherent existence. And so here in the Vipassana section, we saw it's being presented in two sections. The first section was a general presentation of different ways of introducing the ultimate nature of the mind coming from the oral Mahamudra tradition. So we saw lots of instructions there on how to come to see the ultimate nature of the mind. Some of those instructions are similar to the instructions we saw in this meditation just now. And then in the second section of his presentation, which is where we are now, is to extract the essence of all of those oral instructions and to come to clearly see what is this emptiness that we're trying to come to realize, this ultimate nature of the mind, and how to very methodically and clearly come to understand that and then to investigate in a very clear way. And so that's where we are now. And at the moment we're in the top of page 11. So what we've seen so far here is that when this emptiness is established in the text, often they do it on the basis of some physical phenomena because it's easy to see how to come to the rear, to understand that things are empty of independent, findable existence on the basis of using a physical phenomena. But here it said, when we come to meditate on this, then it's recommended to start by focusing on ourselves as a person. How do I exist? And to look and investigate me, the person, me, the meditator. And we saw there that in our investigation, it's very important to what's called clearly identify the object of negation, meaning to come to clearly identify the false sense of me, the me that we're grasping onto. Because as we saw, if we don't have a clear picture of that, then when we come to investigate, then we're not going to come to any clear conclusion as to whether or not that me exists. So then if we can come to a clear sense of this independent me that seems to be here, then we can search thoroughly to see if there is in fact an independent me here or not. And so that's where we were. We left off yesterday, where in that last part of that paragraph, it says in third paragraph, top of page 11, when investigated in this way, the way in which all phenomena such as the being, the I, the person actually exist is as a mere name, merely imputed by conception and merely labelled. So when we come to investigate, we'll come to see that there is no findable me here, no independent me here, because the me is a dependent phenomena. It's something merely labelled, merely imputed by conception. And here then we see following is the way in which we can methodically investigate to come to that conclusion. If we look to the next paragraph, it says, The person does not exist as it appears, since neither of the two individually, the body nor the mind of the person, is the person. The collection of the two, the body and the mind, is also not the person. None of the six elements individually is a person. So the six elements is one way of dividing up persons. So often in a lot of the ancient traditions, when they divide up the physical world, they divide it up into these six elements, physical and mental world. You know, the earth element, which is the solid aspect. We have that in the quote here from Nagarjuna. If we go to, actually to the next quote, it says, as said by the protector Ari Nagarjuna, the person is not earth. Earth element is the solid aspect of the physical world. Not water, the fluid aspect. Not fire, the heat aspect. Not wind, not the movement aspect. Not space, not the absence of physical contact. And not consciousness, not mind. So we can divide the physical and mental world into these six elements. So it says here, none of the six elements individually is the person. The mere collection of the six elements is also not the person. And other than the six elements, there is no person. And so we see that in Nagarjuna's quote, the person is not the earth element, not the water element, not the fire element, not the wind element, not space element, not consciousness element. Nor is the person all of these together. Yet other than them, what person is there? Meaning, other than the six elements, or other than the body and the mind, what person is there to be found? And we have something similar here in a sutra. It says, the body is not the self, the feelings are not the self, discrimination is not the self, compositional factors are not the self, and consciousness is not the self. So, of course, this is talking about the five aggregates. So I think it might be good to just briefly talk about these five aggregates a bit, because they come up a lot in Buddhist texts when we discussing the person. We have this presentation of the five aggregates. So let's briefly have a look at these five aggregates to better understand what they are, because you're going to see them a lot in texts. And here the word aggregate is a translation of the Sanskrit word skanda. And skanda literally means heap, collection, pile. So the person is a collection of five things. The first of the five aggregates is the form aggregate, or rupa in Sanskrit. And when the five aggregates is a presentation of the parts of the person, of course, the form aggregate is the body. And then, of course, the other part of the person is the mind. And there are many ways of dividing up the mind. You can divide it, as we're going to see shortly, you can divide the mind into the six consciousnesses, the five sensory consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. That's one way of dividing up the mind. So we can divide the mind a number of ways. One very common way of dividing up the mind is from the perspective of how the mind functions. And so there we can divide the mind into two. We can divide it into what's called main mind and mental factors. Because in every one of our experiences, the main mind part of the experience is simply the raw experience of the object. And then
On top of that raw experience of the object, we have the mental factors. And the mental factors determine what type of experience we have of that object. And here the mental factors, in Buddhist psychology, usually we come up with a list of 51 of them. And I'm not going to go through the whole list because this is the whole topic itself in Buddhism, often called in Tibetan lo-rig. So you can study this in a lot of detail because this is Buddhist psychology. So in this list of 51 mental factors, I'll just mention a few that are important. 26 of them are mental afflictions. So we can understand that very often our mind is not functioning very well, because we have all these mental afflictions in our mind. In the 26 mental afflictions, we talk about the 6 root mental afflictions, the main ones, and then 20 secondary ones that come from that. And those 6 root mental afflictions we can condense into the 3 poisons, which we've briefly touched on already. The 3 poisons, of course, are ignorance, attachment, aversion. So ignorance is the primary mental affliction, ignorance of reality. And we saw in that chart yesterday that from ignorance, when we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences, they often lead to attachment and aversion. So these are the core mental afflictions, and from that all the other mental afflictions come. So that's more than half of the mental factors are these mental afflictions. Also in this list, what is important is, and we touched on this already in that chart yesterday, there's the mental factor of feeling. In Sanskrit, vedana. This mental factor is present in all of our experiences. And this mental factor of feeling, in Buddhism, again, it doesn't mean emotion. It's simply experiencing things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is a very important mental factor because it's on the basis of this that we end up with a lot of problems. Because when we have a pleasant feeling, we often generate attachment and craving. When we have an unpleasant feeling, we often develop aversion. So this can get us into a lot of trouble. Another mental factor that's important that often gets us into trouble is a mental factor called discrimination. And discrimination here is our ability to clearly distinguish one thing from another. So, of course, if we can't clearly distinguish things, if we discriminate, if we see them in a wrong way, then, of course, often we lead to difficulties and problems. If we don't clearly discriminate things, if we don't see them in a clear, correct way. So this one also often gets us into trouble. Another mental factor which is very important, which of course we saw in shamatha, is mindfulness. That if we have poor mindfulness and we can't focus well, then that also creates a lot of problems. And we need to cultivate that. And of course, we also saw introspection. Monitoring, our ability to monitor, is a mental factor that we need to cultivate. So both mindfulness and introspection we need to cultivate. And of course, other mental factors include wisdom. We need to cultivate this, and so forth. And there are a number of important mental factors. Now, in terms of our experiences and behaviour, then of course, probably the two mental factors which get a lot of attention are these two. Because that's often where we start to get into trouble. Because on the basis of pleasant feelings, we generate attachment,
unpleasant feelings, we have aversion. And if we don't discriminate things correctly, if we don't see them correctly, we interact with them in a very in a way that creates problems. Because of that, because these two are so important to understand, these two mental factors are taken out separately, and they are the two next of the aggregates. So the next two aggregates are feeling and discrimination, to highlight that these are very important to pay attention to. And then the fourth aggregate is all the other mental factors. So we had all the other mental factors together. Once we've taken these two out, is the fourth aggregate, compositional factors. The reason they're called compositional factors here is that these mental factors are literally composing what our future is going to look like. Because depending on which of these are present in our experiences, particularly these mental afflictions, that behavior that's driven by that is composing what our future is going to look like. Because based on our actions, we have experience, we have results. So that's why they're called compositional factors. They are literally composing our future, depending on which ones are present in our behavior. And then the fifth aggregate is the main mind. And here, the main mind is simply called consciousness. In Sanskrit, Vijnana. So these three together is mental factor, and the fifth aggregate is main mind. So we see then the four aggregates together, all those four aggregates is the mind. So when we talk about the five aggregates, if we condense them, we can understand we're just talking about body and mind. And then the mind is divided into these four, particularly to show to us that these two mental factors of feeling and discrimination are very important, and we need to pay attention to them, otherwise we're going to get into trouble. So this is the five aggregates presentation as a way of describing the various parts of the person. So that's one way, of course, of dividing up the person. The other one we saw here is you can divide the person into the six elements. The first five elements of earth, fire, water, wind and space is the body. And the sixth element, the conscious element, mind. So another way of dividing up the body and mind into six. There's a question down the back.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I just wanted to present that because this five aggregates is one of the most common ways of talking about the person in the texts, that the person is made up of the five aggregates. Yeah. Here, the word consciousness is just talking about main mind. Often, when we speak generally, the word consciousness is the same as mind. Here, this is a case where the word consciousness is not equivalent to the mind. It's part of the mind. It's the main mind part of the mind. So again, we have to be careful when we see the word consciousness. In general, when we speak generally, consciousness, mind, awareness are synonymous. Here, the word consciousness is not equivalent to mind. Consciousness here is part of the mind. It's the main mind. So again, we have to be careful with the terminology when we see these words. So mind here, another way of dividing it is into the six consciousnesses, the five sensory consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. Each one of those we could divide in this way. Each one of our consciousnesses, the six consciousnesses, we can divide as main mind and mental factors as well. So the mental consciousness we can divide into a main mind and mental factors. The visual consciousness we can divide into the main mind and mental factors. From where? Over there. They're coming from over there. Of course, thoughts are arising in the mind. They're not coming from somewhere else into the mind. So thoughts, and of course the reason thoughts come up can be many. There can be many reasons or conditions why a thought will arise, but the thought itself arises from within the mind itself, not from somewhere else.
What are their reasons?
Oh, there can be many different stimuluses. It's like in general, there can be external stimulus, internal stimulus, why the thought comes up. Often, we don't see the stimulus because often it's very subtle level. So often, our experience is the thought comes out of nowhere. It's just, boom, there it is. Why is it there? It seems to have just randomly arisen. The reason is that when we talk about levels of mind, you know, we can talk about levels of mind from coarse down to subtle. And now we have like what's called threshold. And it's only above this level do we notice mental activity. At the more subtle level, there's a lot of mental activity going on that is the precursor for coarse mental activity. So then it's only when this precipitates something above this level, we see, oh, there's a thought arising. Where did that come from? We didn't see all of these other subtle mental events which led to that coming up. So as we practice shamatha, this threshold will go down. And what we're going to notice is we're going to start to pick up very subtle activity that's leading to some thought or emotion coming up. And so we're going to be able to more clearly see the sequence of events leading to a thought arising, a memory arising, an emotion arising. That will become more and more clear to us as our mind becomes more stable and clear and this threshold moves down. Well, you could call this subconscious. You could call it unconscious. You could give it many names. But this is not something different than this. They're not two separate things. This is the mind, and we're dividing it this way only in terms of what we are aware of and what we're not aware of.
It's only aware of what we can use it and what we can't use.
Right. And so one of the things, of course, one of the benefits of shamatha practice is that this threshold goes down, which is good, because we're more aware of what's going on in our mind. It means we can not just react, we can do something about this.
Would that also be like memories? Our memories?
What do you mean is it like memories? I mean, the same thing is that a memory just pops out of nowhere and we wonder where.
Because sometimes, in life, we tend to forget things, but then eventually we remember them.
Yeah.
Is that the same process?
Yeah, it means because this is going down, we can gain access to those memories.
Yeah.
And often you'll find in these sorts of retreats, particularly shamatha retreats, that when you're, particularly if you're observing the mind, all of a sudden a memory will pop up that maybe is the first time that you can recall remembering that experience since you've had that experience 20 years ago.
Mm.
This is very common. And that's a sign that this is going down and these things are more accessible and more easy to see.
Does it mean that when we live everyday life,
live everyday life, yeah.
We record everything.
We
record everything.
Yes, yes.
If we can't remember,
yeah.
It means that the possibilities of recording of our memories or conscious is enormous.
Yes,
we record
correct.
Everything, but we can't remember because
correct.
Very often when I try to remember something from the past,
sure.
I can't remember.
Sure.
But it
it's there.
Exists
yes.
somewhere.
That's the Buddhist. Yes, that's correct. That's the Buddhist assertion. Okay. Mental object, yeah.
We think something is external or internal, like ideas. We get to know ideas by consciousness, yes?
Sure, sure.
It's a consciousness, like
sure.
a tool for getting to know the ideas.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and for example, if we are talking about some physical things, we first get, like color, we first get them to know them by discrimination, then
conceptual framework.
Yeah. So, also, and it's also that coming to consciousness. So, by, and it is, it's a kind of a tool to get know the role. Yeah?
Correct.
So, by what tool, when we get to know emptiness? Because it's not something physical and it's not the idea. So, among these tools, these faculties, is that, that thing which we would know the action.
It's the mental consciousness. It's the mental consciousness that can get to know emptiness. The mental consciousness, of course, is conceptual. So, first, and that's what we're going to see now, coming up, is that first we get to know emptiness through concept, through idea.
Yes, but that's only idea. I think we all have that idea.
Correct. So first we get an intellectual idea of emptiness, which is what we've been trying to get. Then in meditation, we internalize that and have a taste of emptiness, but that taste of emptiness, as we're going to see, and I've already mentioned briefly, is also still a concept, an idea. It's in terms of a mental image. We have a mental image. So intellectually, we understand emptiness through concept and idea. When we meditate, we experience that through a mental image, which is still conceptual. That's an object. So that's what's called a conceptual experience or realization of emptiness. If we continue to work at that level and we deepen our mind through shamatha practice, we will break through that and we will come to a direct realization of emptiness, which is non-conceptual, non-dualistic. So then our mind is non-dualistic, non-conceptual, and we know we realize emptiness directly. If we have that experience and we come out of that experience and someone asks us, what did you experience? You'll go,
It was sort of like this. It was like space. It was like... We won't be able to explain it because that experience is beyond concept, beyond being an idea. So we can't explain a non-dualistic, non-conceptual experience using language. All we can do is use language to point towards it. No.
Because, you know, there are five senses,
yeah.
Which are
non-conceptual.
For physical force, and there is the mental.
Correct.
Mental tool for ideas.
Correct.
And there is nothing else. So
correct.
In this presentation, no. I don't see any other mind or any other.
That's because there is no other mind. The mental consciousness, as you said, is conceptual. Ideas, thoughts, concepts. The five sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. We, through the senses, we experience objects directly, not through concept. So our visual consciousness sees colors and shapes directly, non-conceptually. Then, of course, our mental consciousness interprets that experience and goes, oh, that's a laptop. But that mental consciousness, if we train it with shamatha and we make it stable and clear, then with that very same mental consciousness, we can have a non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness. If we don't have shamatha, then there's no way we can bring that idea or concept or mental image of emptiness into a non-conceptual realization.
So, okay, that means like if that mental consciousness, if it is really very strong and strained,
correct.
So it gains some other capacity.
No, it liberates the obscurations which are stopping us now from having that direct experience. Now, our mind is full of mental afflictions and it's agitated and dull. That is blocking us from that direct experience. So we're not gaining a new capacity. We are revealing a capacity that's always been there, but we've not been able to gain access to it because our mind is agitated and dull and full of mental afflictions. So we can't get to that experience because we're blocked by those things. And we can unblock those things through shamatha practice. By making the mind very calm and clear and free of mental afflictions, we can then, which is already a capacity in our mind now, come to a direct realization of emptiness, non-conceptual. And that's how we need to do it. Because if we don't remove these defilements, then we can't gain access to that capacity of the mind that's already there because it's blocked by our agitation and dullness and our mental afflictions. So that's what we're trying to do in the shamatha, is remove that impediment so that we can have a direct realization, a non-conceptual experience of emptiness. Anyway, let's move on. Okay, so if we go down to the bottom of page 11, the last two paragraphs, it says, in that way, none of the five aggregates, the individual six elements, the collection, the shape, or the collection of the meditator is the meditator. And now it comes up with some absurd consequences of one of those things being the person, the me, the meditator. It says, if that were the case, meaning if some part of the person, the body or the mind, is the person, there would be many faults, such as the first one, the basis of designation and the designated phenomena would be identical. So we have a basis of designation, and then we're applying the designation, person, to that basis. So then the person and the basis of the person would be identical, which is illogical. If you have the basis of something, it can't be that thing. Likewise, the appropriated and the appropriator would be identical. So here we talk about that the person appropriates the aggregates. They're called the appropriated aggregates because in this life, the person gets a body and a mind in this life. So then the appropriator, the person, would be the same as the thing that they appropriate, which again would be illogical. And then the same reasoning again, the parts and the whole would be identical. So if the person was the body and the mind, which are the parts, the whole would be the parts. Again, illogical. And if the aggregates were the self, so here the five aggregates, since there are multiple aggregates, there are five aggregates, then there would be multiple selves. So if the aggregates were the self, if they are identical, we have five aggregates, we should have five selves then, if they're identical. So that's another absurd consequence. And then it says, in particular, if the consciousness were the person, and that's often what people then... often people easily understand that the body's not the person, but then when it comes to the consciousness, particularly in Buddhist sphere, when people talk about rebirth and they always talk about it's the mind or consciousness that goes from life to life, then of course then they come to the conclusion, the mind is really the person. So if the consciousness or mind were the person, then we've got some other absurd consequences. If the consciousness were the person, then hearing, speaking, seeing, procreating and so forth would not be tenable. So if the consciousness were the person, we couldn't hear because the consciousness doesn't hear, it's their ear that hears, and the ear is not a consciousness. Speaking also would not be possible because speaking is physical. Seeing also is with the eye organ, and all these physical activities would not be possible if the consciousness were the person. That would be an absurd consequence. And then similarly here, even though there is only one person, just as there are six consciousnesses, there would be six persons. So again, we can talk about the mental consciousness and the five sense consciousnesses. So if there are six consciousnesses and consciousness is person, that would mean there would be six persons. Or alternatively, because there's only one person, the six consciousnesses would be a partless one. You couldn't have the six consciousnesses then. So these are some absurd consequences of the body and the mind being the person, meaning that the person being the same as the body and the mind. So that's an absurd consequence of the person being the same as the body and mind. And then over the page, there's absurd consequences if the person is not the same as the body and the mind. It says, also, other than the five aggregates, there is no person. Because if they were other, meaning if the person and the five aggregates were different, then they would be an inherently unrelated other. Then they would be inherently other. And then the person would not possess the characteristics that characterize the collection of aggregates. So if the person was different than the aggregates, the body and the mind, then the person would, because it's different than the body and the mind, the person wouldn't have any of the characteristics of the body and the mind because it's different than the body and the mind. So that would be an absurd consequence. And if they were other, then there were also many faults. So here, to back that up, there's a quote from a text that says, if they were other, meaning the person and the body and the mind, or the person were other than the aggregates, the person's different than the body and the mind, then it would not have the characteristics of the body and the mind, of the aggregates. So what we're seeing here is that when we do this search for this me that seems to be here, we're searching to see, because if there is an independent me here, it must be findable. And there's only two places it could be. It must either be the same as the body and the mind, or it must be different than the body and the mind, if it's findable. And so we saw just on the previous page that if the person is the same as the body and the mind, we have all those absurd consequences. And if the person's different than the body and the mind, we have these absurd consequences. So here it gives us very clearly how we can approach this meditation. So I'd like to just... And that's the way we did the meditation yesterday, and we're going to do the same meditation again in the next session. So just to clearly lay out this, so it's very clear in our mind. Tenable, acceptable, reasonable, possible. So what we can see here is how we can approach this investigation, this meditation. And that's described with a presentation called the Four Essential Points. This is very clearly laid out in a very easy way to understand in a book from His Holiness Dalai Lama called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. And that's usually the book I recommend for beginners who want to understand about emptiness practice and how to do that and what it means and so forth. Four essential points. And the first of the four points we saw yesterday, earlier in this section, it said that the first thing, the most important thing, is to clearly identify this object of negation. So the first point is the technical word, and the way it's put in the text is identify the object of negation. And in His Holiness' book, he calls this identifying the target. As we saw yesterday, if we're going to search for this me that seems to be here, we need to have first a clear picture of what this me looks like. Otherwise, we can search and we won't come to any conclusion. The same as if we want to search for a person in a crowded room, if we don't have a clear picture of what that person looks like, we can do a lot of searching and not come to any conclusion whether or not the person is in the room. So the first point is to identify the object of negation, to get a clear sense of how we see ourselves existing. And what we did yesterday in the meditation was to help with that. At the beginning of the meditation, we said, you know, imagine someone's criticizing or blaming you for something you didn't do. Usually when that happens, we have a strong sense of me. How dare you criticize me? You know, or if someone's praising us, we often have a strong sense of me, the one that's being praised. That is the object of negation, because that is very clearly appearing to our mind. We have very strong grasping in those occasions, and we have that is appearing very clearly to our mind, the sense of me, the me who's being criticized or praised. So as a beginner, it's good at the beginning of the meditation to think of such a situation and then look at the appearance of me. How does the me appear, this me that's being criticized and blamed? And I think you'll find that it'll appear as something very solid, as a single thing, existing from its own side, not seeming to depend on anything else to exist. That's the me we are identifying with when someone's criticizing us or praising us. That's the me we need to look for, because that me really seems something solid and findable. That's what we need to look for, because that's the me we identify with and on the basis of which we react. So that's the first point. And as I mentioned yesterday, this is often where people go wrong in their meditation. Instead of looking for this me that we identify with, often people simply turn this investigation into an intellectual exercise. And then, of course, they always come up with an answer who the me is, based on their background, based on their reading and own beliefs. And so often Buddhists who start this and don't really look for this, they always come with an answer. I'm the subtle mental continuum, because that's what goes from life to life. That's me. But
But again, if someone's criticizing us, I don't think we're identifying with subtle mental continuum, are we? If we were, we'd never react, but I think we don't. And also sometimes people with other backgrounds understand that actually everything sort of like at a subtle level is just subtle energy. And then often people then go, I'm just a subtle energy field. That's me. I know that because I learnt that. And then of course they come up with this answer. And then they haven't done the meditation. They've just intellectualized and come up with some sort of intellectual answer of who they think they are. Here, we need to look for our instinctive sense of me. And I think instinctively, we don't have a sense of subtle energy field or subtle mental continuum when we're reacting. So this is the most important point. And then as we've seen here, once we have that clear picture and we start searching, then we need to know where to search. And so that's the second point, which the technical word is called establishing the pervasion, but in His Holiness's book, he calls it limiting the possibilities. Means we need to know where to look. If this me exists that we identify with, it must be findable. So it can only exist in one of two places. It can only either be the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind. So that's what the second step is to understand, is where do we need to look? It has to be either the same as the body and the mind or different. And if we look in those two places and we don't find it, it means it does not exist. The findable me does not exist. So that's the second step, understanding where to look. And if we look in those two places and we don't find it, it doesn't exist. Then we look, and here we saw, we look, is it the same as the body and the mind? Is it different than the body and the mind? We can do that in either order, but as here and often it's presented, look first, is it the same as the body and the mind? Is it the same as the body and mind? So then we look in the body, we look in the mind, and see if we can find this me that seems to be here. If we don't find it as the same as the body and the mind, then it must be different than the body and the mind, which would mean you would have to be able to take away the body and the mind and be left with the me. So is there something more than the body and the mind here? And if we see that there's not, then we've looked in both places. We didn't find it. And then that not finding experience is an experience of emptiness. So if we get to the point in our search of not finding, then we stop there. We don't keep searching. We just hold that experience of not finding. That's an experience of emptiness. We hold that as long as we can, allowing that experience to penetrate deeper into our mind. This is where shamatha is very helpful. If we don't have a stable, clear mind and we get to a point of not finding, then it will simply remain as an intellectual idea. It won't have any impact on our mind. And we'll go, okay, it's not there, so what? And then nothing will happen. You know, we'll come out of the meditation and there'll be no change. And we'll go, well, that didn't work. Again, the problem is that we left it at that intellectual level because our mind is not stable and clear. So if we put effort into a shamatha practice and we get to the point of not finding and we can hold that experience with a bit of stability and clarity, that experience, which in there is understanding, is knowledge, because there's knowledge or understanding, there's no findable me, and we hold that, it can have a quite strong impact on our mind. So much so that when we get out of the meditation, that's still affecting our mind. Meaning, not at an intellectual level, but at an experiential level outside the meditation,
things will seem a little bit different. The self-grasping won't be as strong. Mental afflictions will seem to be a little bit less. We'll get less irritated by things. We'll feel more connected with others, more close to others. Maybe for a few minutes, a few hours, maybe a little bit longer, and then slowly, slowly it'll wear off. Grasping will reassert itself. We'll get irritated, we'll react, loving kindness, compassion out the window, and back to normal. So then the next step, of course, is we need to stabilize that experience. And the way to stabilize it, of course, is to work on our shamatha practice. Have a more stable, more clear mind, so that the next time we do the meditation and we hold it, it will penetrate a little bit deeper, meaning that after the meditation, it'll have a little bit more impact and it'll last longer before it wears off. And we have to keep doing that until we can really develop shamatha. And then, when we have this not finding experience, instead of it being an experience that has a little bit of an effect after the meditation, it will be a realization, a stable experience that will last after the meditation, and not simply wear off after a couple of minutes or a couple of hours. So to get to that, we need shamatha. We need a very stable and clear mind. Any questions on that? Otherwise, it's time for a morning tea break. Yeah, down the back.
Back to the number one.
Number one what? This one?
Yeah.
Sure.
If I'm doing the,
First point, don't pick a situation that's too intense, because we'll sort of like pick something a little bit that, and if you don't like the negative, then pick a positive. Someone's praising you, for example.
Could be
anything. Yeah, sure.
If it does create something.
Sure.
And
then just hold that clear appearance. Don't look yet. Don't work out where is that.
No.
That's already the meditation.
Yeah.
So all you do is you rest in that experience and get a clear sense of how that me is appearing to your mind. That's all. That's all you do at the first step.
Yes, and then do I let go of that?
The reason to have a clear appearance is then it's clear in your mind, and then you can recall that when you're doing the search.
Because
it's like, let's say you were looking in a room full of people for this person, and you've never seen the person before, but someone shows you a photo. If you just see the photo and then for half a second, then you go, oh, and then you look, you go, oh, I'm not sure, I can't remember what he looked like. But if you have the photo there for a little while and you study it, you look at it, and you see it very more and more clearly, then you can put it away and you can search, and then you can remember what that looked like. So that's this. Yeah.
In any case, that process of searching, it is intellectual.
No. It's not intellectual. You have this picture of the person that you're supposed to look for, and then you look for the person in the room, do you turn that into an intellectual exercise, or do you just look directly? That's all you do. Same thing. You get the picture of how the me looks like, and then you look directly. You don't turn it into an intellectual exercise. Yeah? Because then you've missed it. It's the same thing. If you're looking for a person in a room and someone gives you a clear picture and you study it, and then you have, oh yeah, okay, I know what that person looks like, and then you go to look for them, do you turn that into an intellectual exercise?
Sure.
No.
Because, for example, in other traditions, for example, in the Dharma, people who they go through the same stages of concentration, and that's the thing they develop that shamatha and dhyanas, but when they say that then they get to that highest stages of concentration, they actually find self, but it's outside. And you know, that's the thing, and the concentration and the meditation is completely the same. But they said that they have discovered that self, and it's Atman or Brahman, the same thing. Okay, if they are just maybe with that power of concentration, what they have now, I'm just not able to discover that self, which is somewhere outside. I just can't see it.
Sure. That's why. If we really want to progress, we have to work on the shamatha. But that doesn't mean we can't start searching before we achieve shamatha. Because even if we have just a little bit of stability and clarity, we can have a little taste of that emptiness. And then that can actually help us as a basis for going more in the shamatha. And then the more we go in shamatha, the deeper we can go into the emptiness. And the deeper we go into emptiness, the more that will help in our shamatha practice. So they will help each other. So we shouldn't think, I haven't got shamatha yet, so I won't bother about vipassana. Of course, now, if we're half asleep and we're distracted every 2 seconds, then yes, doing this investigation is not really going to work. Yeah, I don't know. Is a part of that? I think often is that again people turn it into an intellectual exercise, and then of course I don't know could be an answer because they're trying to intellectually work it out, and it's impossible to intellectually work it out, and so then they come up, oh, I don't know.
Well,
so that's one thing.
You don't know.
So the example is you have a picture of a person and you look in the room. Why would you come up with the answer, I don't know if he's in the room?
Huh? You don't find him.
But it's a small room and there's 10 people and you look, and why would you come up with an answer, I don't know if he's there? A couple of reasons. One, you don't have the clear picture to start with, so maybe it's one of those people or not, because I can't remember what he looked like. Secondly, the room is too dark and you can't see anyone, like we're half asleep, then we don't know. So these are the reasons we would say, I don't know. It's not because we've got a good idea what they look like and we've looked at all the people and we've seen they're not any of those people. We would not then come up and say, I don't know, would we? I mean, it wouldn't make sense.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
But the analogy is not really good because the person who
So it's a
different process, I think. The observer is looking.
Yeah, that's okay. It's the mind that's looking.
Yeah, but the analogy works.
Remember, it's not an example. Analogies are never examples.
Yeah, but this analogy doesn't speak to you.
Sure, okay. Then if it doesn't speak to you, then pick another analogy. It's okay. But it's just to understand the process. Remember, analogies are not examples. I mean, even the snake and the rope, if you take it too far, you can say, but there's no, that rope doesn't perform the function of a snake. Of course it doesn't, but that's not the analogy. So, again, yes, here, we're using our own mind to look for the me. But again, it's not an intellectual process. If we leave it as an intellectual process, then of course we're going to go, I don't know, or whatever. So we just look directly, that's all. Let's take a break because we've run over time, and then maybe some more questions in the next session. So let's take a tea break and come back.